Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of this podcast. Coming your way every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom. And always make sure you tell a friend who either once collected or who still does to check us out twice a week and also check out our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, we'll get to our comments on our Twitter feed, quite a few this week, not only talking about our previous podcast on 88 Tops, but a little bit about today's podcast. We gave you a little tease about the set that we're going to talk about, the 1989 Upper Deck set, a legendary set which really not only set the bar, but changed the hobby for better and for worse. It depends on your take on it. Either you love the Upper Deck debut and how it changed things, or perhaps it even drove you out of collecting because it totally turned the hobby on its ear. And as we mentioned in the 88 Score podcast a couple weeks ago, you know, Upper Deck, some of the things that they're given credit for, Score beat them to it in 1988. So we'll get to your comments. We'll talk about the history of Upper Deck, which is a very entertaining, interesting, and sordid history. And we'll also take a look at our random pull, card number 364, Cecil Fielder in a Blue Jays uni. I was a Blue Jays fan as a kid, and the powder blue Blue Jays uni. Seeing Cecil stuff himself into that uniform on the back of this card is pretty entertaining. So we'll talk about Cecil Fielder, his up and down career and life, and that's also a story full of all sorts of misfortune, not just him, but his family members. So we'll get to that. We'll get to the Upper Deck story. Let's get to our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed because we've got lots of commentary and we just got to cut to the chase right now. Talking about our podcast on 88 Tops, a set that I was never a big fan of, and it's kind of split down the middle. You know, I never really thought that 88 Tops was one of those sets where you either loved it or you hated it. I actually thought a lot of people just didn't like it. I didn't think that there was, you know, an A or a B, but based on your comments, you can be on the fence on it. You can love it or you can hate it. And we start off with some comments from Booby Main, again, one of my favorite Twitter handles, who follows us. RobbieT86 is the actual handle. A fantastic design killed by overproduction and an awful rookie class, just like 88 Fleer and Score. And you're right on the mark there, Bobby, as we've got an okay set that was really undermined by overproduction, and that was something that would kill a lot of sets in 88, 89, 90, 91. But also, you know, the lack of big star rookies. Tom Glavine, pretty much the big rookie in that set. I know Ken Caminiti's rookie was in there, and there's probably one or two others I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. But it was an underwhelming rookie class. There were way too many cards that were out there in the market. And even though 88 Tops, you can make a case for it being a decent set, an okay set, most people just really look down upon it because of those reasons. The overproduction and, you know, the rookie class was not that great that year. Ben Adams chiming in, I have to agree, very lackluster when I think generic baseball card. That comes to mind. Ben also responding to a tweet, we said pass or fail 88 Tops. He said fail, maybe because it's a giant letdown from the 87 set. And that's what I said in the podcast. You know, after Tops had that iconic 87 set, and it really is iconic. I think it's the best set of the 80s. Now, you could argue 83 Tops is right up there, and why not? But, you know, after that big 87 Tops set, 88 was such a boring, bland design that it's very easy to basically come down from the high of 87 Tops and look at 88 Tops and go, eh, and you know, you're not thrilled about it. RJ630 compares it to the 1966 Tops set. Not crazy about the diagonal. And you know what, RJ, you're right. There is a lot of similarities to the 66 Tops set, which in terms of classic sets was never one of my favorites. In fact, I think I more aggressively bought the 2015 Topps Heritage set, which was designed after the 66 Topps. I think after collecting a lot of those cards, I had a little more respect for the 66 set, but I was never a big fan of that one. And really, the big difference between those two is 66 Topps, that diagonal bar with the team name is in the upper left-hand corner, while the diagonal bar with the player's name is in the lower right-hand corner of 88 Topps. In fact, they both had orange on the back of their cards. Imagine that. Also, iWatchVHS, that's a great Twitter handle, says that the 88 set, boring after the great 87 cards. That's a very common theme there. Now, while some of us don't like 88 Topps, some of you do. And this kind of opened my eyes a little bit that there might be a 50-50 split here. Dabs McPlenty says the set is classic. FCKC Chris, I love this set. And also Wax Pack 916. We've had some of your comments on a previous podcast. You mentioned it was your first set that you collected, and they were the first packs given to me by my mom. And that is a big connection to a set there. That's one reason why I love 89 Topps, even though the 89 Topps set is not spectacular. That was the first set I was exposed to. You know, it was my mother who bought a few packs at a grocery store that got me collecting. So good reasons for you to love that set. Absolutely. All right. Kevin Hickerson, was this the first Topps card to have a 3D feel? Past cards did not have any of the pictures in front of the team name. Now, when I first saw this question and responded to it on Twitter, Kevin, I actually misunderstood it a little bit. I thought you just meant any kind of 3D effect. In that case, no, this is not the first time that there's been a 3D effect by Topps. In fact, it was done in 1980 with the beauty contest sash effect at the top left-hand corner, bottom right-hand corner of the card. Top left-hand corner would have the player's position. The right-hand corner had the team name on it. But also, you can go back to the 1960s, 1962 Topps, where it was kind of like 87 Topps, although more of a wanted poster feel, because the lower right-hand corner of the player's picture was rolling up a little bit, like the glue that was holding it down to the wood backing was dried up and the picture was rolling up. So there was a little bit of a 3D effect there, but also one of my favorite sets, the 65 Topps set, which had the team name and logo, and you got some classic old school crests in the pennant shape on the lower left hand corner. And the pennant was designed to kind of lift up a little bit and jump out a little bit, at least in terms of 1960s technology. So there were some 3D effects that were done before by Topps, but when I reread your question, I saw the point that you were trying to make. The player is standing out above the team name. And I looked back at a few cards, and you're right. It wasn't every card, but when Topps had the opportunity to design the card to where the team name was put in the background and the player could stand out in the foreground, they did that. And if you look back at the picture of Glenn Davis, the card that we pulled, our random pull from that podcast, you see that there is a little bit of three-dimensional view here with the team name Astros behind Davis as he's swinging at a pitch, and then with his name bar in the lower right-hand corner kind of sticking out. There is a little bit of depth being provided there. So good eye, Kevin. Again, something that didn't jump out at me at the time, but it would have been in terms of a full 3D effect. Topps definitely did try to do that in 88. So I commend you for finding that and pointing that out there. It wasn't Topps' first attempt at doing some kind of element that was 3D, but to kind of give a 3D perspective to some of their cards, they did indeed manage to do that in 88 Topps. And certainly taking a page from 87 Fleer, which as we mentioned with our Kent DeColve random pull, they did that very well with their design. The players were able to pop off the cards just a little bit. So that was a growing trend in the industry. And you would see, like, I know, 88 Fleer did it, as we mentioned, 89 Fleer as well. Some companies try to just tweak the depth perception of some photographs just to make them leap out at you just a little bit. Now, plenty of reaction to our tease about this podcast, 89 Upper Deck. And it all started with a picture that I found. It was a box. It's the wax box, just the top lid. And I noted that in the lower right-hand corner, you have a little bar, kind of like 88 Tops here. And it says, new, you know, with an exclamation point. And I said, it was more than new, it was revolutionary. And everybody pretty much agrees on that. Starting off with Lost Ways 27, Upper Deck change cards forever with a stronger card, both sides full color, and the little hologram. And a couple people chimed in on that conversation. Cheese Curd saying, completely agree, ranks up there with hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit the first time, redefined everything. Yeah, if you were a teenager, 1991, and Nirvana's Nevermind album came out, chances are that really changed your life. Another album, by the way, that I would highly recommend, Beck's Odelay from 1996. I remember going into a store and pressing play. Devil's Haircut was the first track on that. It just blew my mind. Love that album. All right, back to baseball cards here. Cheese Curd also continues. I remember how weird the foil packaging felt opening a pack. The smell of the cards was foreign to me also. Well, part of that is because of the cardstock and the UV coating, you know, the glossy coating that was on it. The other thing was there was no bubble gum in there, so you know the smell that we were so used to as kids when we opened up packs of baseball cards, it wasn't there. So a lot of people agreeing on our thought that it was not just a new set, it was revolutionary. And then a very interesting comment from Baseball and More. By the way, Baseball and More, I see on your Twitter bio it says lawyer, Duke grad, a-hole. So you've got the trifecta going there. Good job. But I kid. I'm just joking around here. Yeah, lawyer jokes, they're easy. So Baseball and More sends us a picture of Dwayne Bice, a relief pitcher for the California Angels. And if you look at the picture that he sent, it looks like an 89 Upper Deck card, but not quite. Well, that's because it was a demo card. It was a promotional card, you know, before the final cards went to press. This was kind of an example. This is what the card was going to look like. And Baseball and More brings up the question, why was Dwayne Bice one of the promo cards? Stay tuned. Well, thank you, Baseball and More, for what we in the broadcasting business call a seg, because Dwayne Bice is a key factor in the creation and pretty much destruction of the Upper Deck baseball cards. So let's seg into our discussion about 89 Upper Deck, and it's going to be a lengthy one, but we need to give this set its due because it not only turned the hobby on its ear in 1989, but it changed things over the next several years. And here we are 27 years after it was released. It still affects the baseball card hobby. Even though Upper Deck does not produce baseball cards anymore, they're big on the hockey card side. But Upper Deck, still to this day, the release of the 89 set affects how cards are made, how they are marketed, how they are packaged, how collectors collect them. And it's really incredible how this set changed things. So let's start with the story of Dwayne Bice. Now, if you don't recall who Dwayne Bice was, as I mentioned, he was a relief pitcher with the California Angels. And if you just look at his statistics, Dwayne Bice, on the surface, at best, a career minor league pitcher who had a couple of years late in his career in the big leagues, but not much else. Bice's career started in 1977. He was signed by the Giants as an amateur free agent. Then there was a minor league draft in 1980. The Cross Bay rival Oakland A's draft him. And he was in the Oakland system for the early 80s, much of the early 80s. Granted free agency. Signs with the Cleveland Indians. Gets released by the Cleveland Indians. About a year and a half later, he signs with the California Angels. And he's just kind of lost in the Angels farm system. Several times in his career, he gets close to making the big leagues, but just can't crack AAA into the major leagues. Well, he finally gets his chance in 1987 as a relief pitcher and as a closer. Now, let's remember where the California Angels were in 1987. Donnie Moore, the victim of the Dave Henderson home run in Game 5 of the ALCS, which just totally shafted the Angels' hopes of making the World Series for the first time in franchise history. And, of course, they got blown out by Boston in Game 6 and Game 7. Well, Donnie Moore struggled, to put it very nicely, on the field and off the field. That home run that he gave up and the grief that he got because he gave up that home run launched him into a depression. He couldn't pitch anymore. Sadly, a few years later, he would take his life. Well, the opportunity of Donnie Moore faltering on the mound, well, that came to Dwayne Bice. He comes up at the age of 29. He's making his debut with the Angels, and he has a pretty good season in 1987. He appears in 57 games. He has 17 saves, an earned run average of 3.39, a strikeout-to-walk ratio of about 2.5 to 1. So it's appearing that Dwayne Bice, this good human interest story, the 29-year-old rookie who finally gets a chance and is making a really good effort of it, this may be the solution to the Angels' problems. If Donnie Moore can't get his act together, we'll just throw Dwayne Bice out there. Everything is good. Now, remember that season, 1987. That's key to our conversation about how Dwayne Bice gets involved with Upper Deck. Now, 1988 comes around, and Bice slips backwards, appears in only 32 games, earned a run average of 5.88, three saves, strikeout-to-walk ratio slips a little bit to 2-1, starts having some injury issues, so the Angels decide to move on from him, as they were bringing up Ryan Harvey, who was an all-star closer, so they decide to move Bice in 1989. They send him off to Toronto for Cliff Young, another relief pitcher who just barely hung into the major leagues for a few years. So in Toronto, Bice appears in just 7 games, really just stinks up the joint, has an earned run average of 5.82, is giving up more walks than strikes, just doesn't work out. So the Blue Jays decide to release him at the end of the 89 season. And for all intents and purposes, that should be the end of the Dwayne Bice story. But remember what happened in 1987. So let's travel back to 87. A now legendary story in the hobby industry is Dwayne Bice in 87, and this is in the fall of 87. He's driving around Yorba Linda, California. Now, this is just a few minutes outside of Anaheim. So he is somewhat of a recognizable figure, especially because of his performance in 1987. Well, one day he's looking for a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant. He can't find it. He's driving around in circles trying to find this particular restaurant. Now, back in the day, before we all had Google Maps at the touch of our fingertips on our mobile phones, you had to actually stop your car, get out, and ask for directions. So Bice walks into a baseball card shop. He's looking for directions to this particular restaurant. And the owner of the shop, Bill Hemrick, recognizes who Bice is. Hey, what do you know? I've got this Major League Baseball player in my store. So they strike up a conversation. Several weeks later, they're striking up a friendship. Several weeks after that, they're striking up a business partnership. The name of the baseball card shop that Bice walked into, The Upper Deck. So it's amazing how things are aligning here. So as they're becoming business partners, well, Hemrick has another business partner, Paul Sumner. So Hemrick tells Bice, he says, you know, Paul and I, we're trying to start up this baseball card. We want to create a higher quality card that is, counterfeit proof, that is in limited numbers. So it's going to be a pretty hot item as soon as it gets out. And we're trying to produce this, but we can't get licensed by the Major League Baseball Players Association. So basically, Hemrick kind of uses Bice as an in to the Players Association. Now, the backstory to the Players Association is, according to legend, even though Hemrick and Sumner were knocking on the door saying, we've got this really good product and it can make you lots of money, the Players Association at the time were just saying, no, do you know what? We're still, this is 1987. You're like, we've already granted another license, that, of course, to the Score Company. We're going to wait 3 years. Now, think about this. Remember what I said about how the Players Association helped create the hobby boom in the 80s by allowing more and more sets to be officially licensed. So these card companies could use the player likenesses, could use team logos and names, and the players made the money off of signing numerous contracts, so they got more money just to have their likenesses used. But then there was also a cutback from card sales, or a kickback, I should say, a kickback of card sales. So it was another revenue stream for players, something that they definitely needed as the turbulent 80s labor relationship between the players and the owners continued on. Now look at the timeline. 1981, we have Fleer, Donruss, and Topps. So it's the first year of Fleer and Donruss. Well, you have a big player strike right in the middle of the season. So 1988 comes around. You have the collusion issue with the owners not signing free agent players to any contract. In most cases, only a handful of players got contracts, and if they did, they were well under market value. So basically, the Players Association is telling the guys from Upper Deck, Hemric and Sumner, they're saying, well, we're going to wait until, probably 1990. Well, if you remember in 1990, there was a lockout during spring training. The start of the season actually got pushed back by a few days. So the Players Association was timing these baseball card releases to win the next likely work stoppage was going to be. It was actually a very smart business decision. Well, Bice opens up the door and is able to work things up the ladder to where the quality of the card and the quantity of the card, as in far less of a release than what Topps, Fleer, and Score, and Donruss were doing at the time, the Players Association figured out very quickly, well, we could make quite a bit of money off of this company. So they decided to grant the license at the end of 1988. They give the license so that Upper Deck could release the cards in 1989. And that turned out to be very fortuitous for the Players Association because heading into that 1990 lockout, they got a pretty good injection of cash. Now, because of Bice's efforts, what happened was Hemric and Sumner decided to give him a 12% cut of the company. So that's a pretty good deal for Dwayne Bice, who one day is lost trying to find a Chinese restaurant and instead ends up being a minority owner in a baseball card company, which, of course, Bice and Hemric and Sumner couldn't have had any idea would be as smashing as a success as it was. Of course, they think that they're going to have success, but nobody had any idea that it would turn out the way that it did. So that is why Dwayne Bice is featured on the promo card for Upper Deck. So thank you, Baseball More, for sharing that card. By the way, there are still versions of the promo card still floating out there. I actually saw one, I think, on eBay for $30. So, you know, the card that wasn't a card with the certainly less than well-known name and face of Dwayne Bice is still out there. But that is why Dwayne Bice, a rather forgettable relief pitcher who had one good season in 1987, was out of the bigs by 1989. That's why Bice was on that card. And that is how Upper Deck was born. Now, the interesting thing about Bice, we'll talk a little bit about the 89 set in just a little bit, but as I mentioned, Bice not only was able to help launch Upper Deck, but he pretty much brought it down. A story that Darren Rovell did for ESPN way back in 2003 has some interesting details about how Bice was paid. After 1989, he collected $2.8 million. But he saw how quickly these cards were going out of the warehouse, how quickly they were being hoarded by collectors, how high the card prices were for individual cards, for wax boxes, for complete sets. And he thought, wait a minute, 12%, and I'm only getting $2.8 million. Something's not right here. So he thought that he was owed more. He sued Upper Deck, and eventually they agreed to a settlement, which reportedly gave him $17 million. Now, he also still had a stake in the company. So not only did he get these payments from this lawsuit over time, but he also continued to get payments for their production. So what happens is, while Upper Deck is just owning the hobby for the next several years, the baseball strike of 1994, which kills the sport, and kills the hobby, almost kills Upper Deck. To make things worse, they still had an agreement with Bice. So Upper Deck is still printing out cards 95, 96, 97, but they're getting limited revenues because baseball fans had recoiled from the strike. Baseball card hobbyists had either stopped collecting altogether like I did or were drastically reducing their spending on it. So Upper Deck was in the red. And one of the reasons why Upper Deck was in the red was they still had to cut a check to Dwayne Bice for, you know, residuals from the lawsuit and also, you know, from sales. So Bice, who started Upper Deck nearly 10 years later, drove it right into the ground. And in Rovell's story, it's very interesting when the final payment was made in 1988, the Upper Deck company headquarters ordered everyone to work just half a day. They partied when they sent Dwayne Bice his last check, finally removing the last few feathers of the albatross around their neck. Rovell continues, later that year at the Christmas party, Upper Deck CEO Richard McWilliam told employees that the company's deal with Bice was the worst deal it had ever done. Well, perhaps hindsight being 2020, but, you know, just like any other hot commodity, whether it be baseball cards or stocks and bonds or real estate, you have to know when to buy low and when to sell high. And if you were an investor in Upper Deck, if you were fortunate like Dwayne Bice, you got in early and then you cashed your chips in around 92 or 93. But for the long-term employees, they definitely suffered. Long-term investors, too, definitely suffered because Upper Deck was a shell of itself by the late 1990s, even though the sport of baseball and the hobby was starting to recollect itself and get back on its feet. Upper Deck was just absolutely gutted, not only because of the strike, but because Dwayne Bice, well, thought he deserved more than $2.8 million. And why not? You know, you open the door for them and you get 12%. I can guarantee you, and I haven't seen Upper Deck's books, but I can guarantee you that they made more than, let me do the math real quick, probably made more than $24 million, which is what, 12%. You know, $2.8 million would be roughly 12% of $24 million in 1989, based on just the Ken Griffey Jr. card itself. Now, speaking of the Jr. card, some very interesting stories about that card and the set, actually done in an article by Beckett. You could still find it on Beckett.com. This is just a few months ago, and I highly recommend you read it. Secrets of the 1989 Upper Deck Baseball Checklist and the Most Famous Ken Griffey Jr. Rookie Card. Now, I'm not going to read all of the details here, but they have an interview with Tom Guidman, and he has some very interesting insights into the star rookie subset, you know, why the first 26 cards were the rookie cards, why they chose Ken Griffey Jr. as number one. And what's interesting is the other players who were kind of in contention for that number one card. And let me read you just some of the names of players that were in the group of players they were considering for that number one card. You had Sandy Alomar Jr., who, of course, had a very good career, kind of got overshadowed by Roberto, his brother, later on in life. Gary Sheffield, who had a very good career, was the nephew of Dwight Gooden, so there was a lot of storylines there. Greg Jeffries, the darling of the hobby in 88, 89, of course, fizzled out shortly thereafter. And then you have Griffey, who was the single A player of the year, and he goes on to explain why they chose Griffey over some of these other well-known players, and he says that he knew that Fleer, Donruss, Topps, and Score would have Jeffries and Sheffield and Alomar, but they wouldn't have Griffey, and he was absolutely right. All the other companies, they had to bring Griffey on in their update sets. So Upper Deck was able to scoop everybody, and they just had a hunch that Griffey would get a chance to eventually make it to the major leagues in the 1989 season, mostly because the Mariners were just a terrible team, and why not give him a chance? So they took a really big risk. He had an upside, but there was no doubt he was the best player. You know, if you looked at his skill set, He was the best player of the four, would likely have a longer career than the four. So much like, and Beckett refers to this, much like Mark McGwire, you know, in 85 tops, or Roger Clemens and Kirby Puckett in the Fleer Update set in 1984, Upper Deck went out on a limb, and boy, did they just hit the lottery here. That card, of course, number one, which was photoshopped, by the way, not with the Photoshop program, but with a more expensive program. You know, that picture of Griffey, he's actually in his single-A uniform, so they doctored it up to look like a Seattle Mariners uniform. They really just hit it big. That card is still very valuable, not quite $150 a piece or $200 a piece like it was back in the day, but still an ungraded rookie card for Ken Griffey Jr. in mint condition you can still get for about $50 compared to other cards from 1989. That is extremely valuable. And then depending on the grading service and what the final grade is, you can find the Griffey Jr. card for anywhere from $300 to $500 or $1,000. It is still very much a hot property on the market. And then, you know, going on elsewhere in this interview, some very interesting things. And again, I encourage you to read it. It's called Secrets of the 1989 Upper Deck Baseball Checklist and the Most Famous Ken Griffey Jr. Rookie Card from Beckett.com. Some very humorous things. For example, the company, while they certainly hit it out of the park with Ken Griffey Jr. on card one, card number three, Tony Chance, a prospect with the Pirates and not a very good card, he fizzled out. So basically there was an inside joke. Upper Deck, every year they would find the one rookie that they felt wouldn't survive in the big leagues, and they would put him in the number three spot. So legendary names like Tom Dreis and DJ Dozier and Brian Jordan ended up there. Also a very humorous story about numbering. You know, Topps used to put the number one card was reserved every year for a very special player, and Topps still does that to this day. In fact, they're running a contest now. You can pick from a list of several players who would be number one in the 2017 set. So Topps would give top billing to the number one card. Big numbers, big round numbers like 100, 200, 300, those were superstars. Semi-stars, you would get like 350 or 275, and then everybody else just got a random number. Well, there wasn't, you know, once you got past the rookie set, there wasn't a whole lot of logic into the numbering afterwards. But Tom brings up in this very funny story, he was an Angels fan. And of course, this is the year after the Dodgers won the World Series. He hated the Dodgers. So they have a picture of Kirk Gibson with the World Series logo, and it's Gibson trotting around the bases in game one after he hit that game-winning home run. And they assigned that card to card number 666. So the devil is in the details there with 89 Upper Deck. So again, I highly recommend you check out that story from Beckett.com. It was released just a few months ago on their website. So while that article has some very interesting inside stories behind the creation of 89 Upper Deck, the whole idea why Hemrick and Sumner wanted to start the Upper Deck card set, being card shop owners, they knew some of the problems going on in the industry, and they didn't want to just make a high-quality, low-quantity set just to make a mint off of scarcity, but also they wanted to try to curb counterfeit cards that were flooding the market. Now, there was card shaving going on. It still happens today, by the way, but dealers being very precise in altering cards to make the near-mint cards mint condition once again. You had fake cards being produced. You know, color printing processes were streamlined and much improved by the late 1980s. So it was quite possible, if you had the money and the know-how, you could reprint your Wade Boggs and Don Mattingly and Roger Clemens rookie cards and sell them at a premium price to an unsuspecting public. So that was becoming rampant. And you can imagine these guys, you know, they'd have people come in with a handful of cards, go, oh, what are these worth? And they go, well, they're worth nothing. It's fake. So they wanted to curb that. But another thing that they wanted to curb in the world of card counterfeiting was wax pack tampering. And this is something that still goes on today. You'll have some people that buy old wax wrappers. They'll get a handful of common cards from that year's set, and they will, with a heating roller, if you will, a heating press, they'll reseal the pack and then try to sell it for $20, $30, whatever it is. That's why if you ever go on like eBay or any other auction site and you see a pack of like 77 tops going on for $2.99, either the pack is damaged and the owner is just trying to get rid of it, or it's been tampered with and you're just going to end up with a pack full of common cards and somebody's going to make a bunch of money off of basically a recycled wrapper, which is not good. Well, that was certainly happening back in the 80s as Topps, Fleer, and Donruss were still packing their cards in wax packs, but also the score set. The 88 score set was actually in plastic wrappers, but it wasn't like the cello-pack wrappers. If you recall, they were kind of baggy plastic wrappers. There was, the cards would kind of shift around in the pack a little bit. So if you had a heat sealer, you could very carefully, cut open the pack, search the pack, pull out the star cards, drop in a couple of common cards, and then very carefully seal the pack. Now, you wouldn't be able to get away with that at a card show or a card shop, but you could very easily sell them secondhand at a flea market or garage sale or something and make some money off of packs that you already know are just full of common cards. So that is why two of the innovations that came from Upper Deck came around. Now, first of all, take care of the card counterfeits. Upper Deck introduced the hologram sticker on the back of the card, a very, very small baseball diamond-shaped sticker where if you held it up in the light, you were able to get the hologram going. And at that time, that was the best way to combat counterfeit items. You saw it eventually in paper currency. You would see holograms or hologram-like imagery in dollar bills, but also on merchandise. They would put hologram stickers on it to tell you that this was indeed an authentic piece of merchandise or memorabilia, as the case may be. So that is how Upper Deck was able to guarantee right out of the pack the cards that you were getting were going to be the real deal. This wasn't just somebody with a printing press. Now, nowadays, you can, if you really have the money and know-how, you can recreate holograms. So it's not the best way of stopping counterfeit printing. But in 1989, it was very state-of-the-art. Now, the ironic thing is, and you'll hear stories from collectors who will tell you, hologram stickers from 1989 are a reason why they can't get gem mint sets together. Because after 27 years, these stickers, the foil on it, it flakes a little bit. So the rest of the card may be in mint condition, but it's the hologram logo that's peeling off or flaking off, and that actually brings the value of the card down. So it's kind of odd, much like Dwayne Bice started Upper Deck and almost killed it. The hologram logos on the backs of the cards that were supposed to make the card set more valuable, well, they did, but now it's very hard to pull a set together because just with wear and tear and oxidation on the stickers, it's made them flake off a little bit and brought down the value of cards. So a very odd coincidence right there. Now, another thing, as for wax pack tampering, the Upper Deck people would wrap the cards in foil. So foil was not something like the score packages with the light, soft plastic, that baggy plastic that you could, with an X-Acto knife, you could very gently cut along the back seam, search the pack, and then with a heat sealer, seal it back up, and most people wouldn't know the difference. Well, you couldn't do that with foil. You could certainly cut the pack very gently, but once it was cut, there was no way that wasn't obvious that you were resealing the pack. So that was very innovative, and you would see within a few years, all the major car companies, if they weren't doing it with foil, like the people at Upper Deck were, the very tough gauge foil, almost like a tin foil, they were doing it with kind of a, the flashy lighter foil, that, again, couldn't be easily masked if you were reheating it and sealing it. And also cellophane. You know, they would go basically to cellophane wax packs, if you will, as the wax pack would effectively die. I believe in 1991, I think, was the last year of true wax packs. Fleer had the last wax pack, but, you know, by then everybody else was going either to cellophane or some kind of foil or plastic wrapper there. So Upper Deck did change the game there, even though Score did it first with the soft plastic for a true counterfeit-proof packaging. Upper Deck found the magic in that tougher tin foil. Now, one other interesting thing that Upper Deck did that really did change how the whole hobby was run was how they inserted the cards. In fact, if you look at that picture of the 89 box, the second from last item there, you know, they have a laundry list of reasons why you should buy that product. The second to last item says random sequencing, and that was a big thing, especially with Tops. You know, Tops used to do sequencing with the sheets. The sheets that they printed out, there would be, if you look on the older card sets, very closely on the backs of the cards, you would see some kind of a code at the bottom of the card. And it was typically something like asterisk and then the letter B, you know, something like that. Well, if you could press down the wax hard enough, or especially with cello packs and rack packs, if you just looked at the back of the card, you could see what the sequence was. And there was basically an algorithm where if you could, you know, if it was star C on the bottom of the third pack, then you were pretty much guaranteed of, you know, a Mark McGwire rookie card in the second pack. So you would have people searching packs like that in retail stores, you know, not necessarily opening the packs and searching them, but using the sequencing codes to try to figure out what cards were likely in those packs. So they were gaming the system there. Well, Upper Deck would try to squash that by having a truly random sequence. 700 cards in the base set. Random sequence, who knows, maybe you get a Ken Griffey Jr. card, or maybe you get a whole bunch of commons. And I've heard some stories where, you know, people would get packs that had three Griffey Jr. cards. So the sequencing, while random, could be a little too haphazard. Although if you ended up with three Griffey Jr. rookie cards out of 89 Upper Deck, good for you. Now, the set, as I mentioned, 700 card base set, they would add a second series. They called it high number series. It wasn't, you know, update or traded or a rookie series. It was just the high number series. And that was card number 701 through 800. And you got to see in 89 Upper Deck how they did that. In the base set, you had a very interesting shot of Nolan Ryan, for example, his card, a triple exposure of him delivering a pitch. Well, Nolan Ryan at the time was a member of the Houston Astros. Of course, he signed with the Texas Rangers at the start of the 89 season. So in that update set, or the high number series, I should say, you had him with the Texas Rangers. But what was interesting was Nolan Ryan, in warming up his arm, was throwing a football. So that was a very unique picture. Here is a Hall of Fame pitcher still going strong at the age of 40, chucking a football around. It was very unique. And the photography of 89 Upper Deck made it set itself apart from all the others. Now, Fleer would try some different goofy poses. Jay Johnstone wearing, the Budweiser umbrella hat. But Upper Deck did really more candid moments. If you look at the Mike Schmidt card, of course, Schmidt had retired by then, but it's Mike Schmidt getting interviewed by a reporter. Now, that is hardly an action shot, but that's part of the game that very few people got to see. So you had some very candid pictures in the 89 Upper Deck set, whether it be Mike Schmidt getting interviewed by a radio reporter or Nolan Ryan throwing a football around. And that's what helped differentiate the 89 Upper Deck set from a lot of other sets in 1989. So let's take a look at the random pull card that we have here to look at the design of 89 Upper Deck. Card number 364, Cecil Fielder looking at his bat like it's a big old state fair corn dog. And, you know, it's so funny. We talk about how Upper Deck changed the game. yet they still had a lot of the same designs that the other car companies had. You know, Upper Deck would eventually take over the industry in terms of, you know, with the front of the card where the picture dominated the entire card. More picture, less graphics. Well, the 89 Upper Deck set is actually one of the most cluttered sets in 1989. But because of the scarcity of the cards, because of the photo quality, because of the cardstock quality, people kind of let that go by the wayside. So the picture actually only takes up about 85% of the card. There is plenty of space for white border, a lot of white space on this card. You have the player's name in the lower right corner, the Upper Deck logo in the lower left corner. Just above the player's name is the team logo, which really looks sharp, you know, kind of a high-res logo compared to other cards with their cardboard stock and the quality of printing. Also along the right side, you have a baseline. It's basically the first baseline. And what was neat about Upper Deck, they moved that baseline around over the next three sets. So, or two sets, I should say. So 89, you had the first baseline. If you look at the 1990 set, the first to second baseline runs along the top. The 91 set, you have the second to third baseline running along the left-hand side, and then, you know, on the lower right-hand corner, the team logo was in a home plate-shaped space. So you kind of had second to third to home. And then in 92, they totally abandoned that idea and kind of went to that almost exclusively all picture design and very little border. So maybe you didn't notice that before. You have the base paths running around from first to second, and then to third in the 89, 90, and 91 sets, respectively. Now, the photograph, even though it didn't take up the whole card, it certainly took up a large enough part of the card and made the 89 Upper Deck set very striking. Certainly, while it did share a lot of the same assets as some of the other cards that were released then, it did look very, very different. And one reason why it looked very, very different was the back. If you flip the card over, so you have the card number in the upper left-hand corner. You have normally an action shot, full-color action shot, crystal clear, high-resolution photography, taking up roughly, I'd say, 60% of the card. And at the bottom, you had that Upper Deck hologram logo. And to the right, you had the player stats kind of jammed into this, you know, sidebar, if you will. And then the player's pertinent personal information in the upper right-hand corner. No baseball trivia, no interesting tidbits about the player, no telling us what scout signed him. They just got down to business. Here's the player's name, here's his stats, and here's this really huge picture of the player. That really changed the game. The backs of the cards more than the fronts of the cards, because by 1991 you saw more use of the back of the card. FLIR started to put color photos on the backs of the card again. By 1992, pictures on the back of the card were very commonplace, and I'm thinking of, you know, a lot of sets. Topps started doing it. Donruss started doing it. You know, everybody basically had full color, almost full back of the card photographs on the back, which was a complete turnaround from what they did just a few years before. So, you know, in many ways, the back of the card was more revolutionary than the front of the card for Upper Deck. Now, we'll talk about our random poll topic, Cecil Fielder, in just a moment, but some final thoughts on the 89 Upper Deck card and how it changed the hobby. As I said at the beginning of this podcast, for better or for worse. Now, for better, collectors looking for a high-quality, low-quantity set, they got it not only in Upper Deck, but as time would go on through pretty much every other set. So if you were just looking for better quality, better looking cards, or if you were investing cards and you didn't like the deluge of cards that were out, you wanted a little more limited edition, that is one way that Upper Deck changed the hobby. You started getting smaller runs for sets. Now, Upper Deck never released the total number of sets or cards that they put out in the market in 1989, but it is pretty well understood that the 89 Upper Deck set is in much less supply than all the other companies back in 1989. If you want 89 Tops or Fleer or Donruss or Score or Bowman, they're out there. You can find them, and you can find them for just pennies on the dollar. But 89 Upper Deck, still all these years later, still has a bit of a scarcity to it, to where there's a lot of value. Now, with 90 and 91 and 92 and 93, Upper Deck did start ramping up the number of cards produced, still probably not as many as some of the other companies, but they still had the low end of the number of cards that were put out there, but they still put out more in those subsequent sets than what you saw in 89. So it's a little easier to find 91, 92, 93 Upper Deck, certainly than 1989. So that's one way that it helped the industry. The other way that it helped the industry is that it gave people a pretty good choice of cards that you could shop for. In many ways, if you can kind of look at the 1989 year of baseball cards, almost like General Motors. For years, General Motors sold 7 or 8 different brands of cars that reached out to a different audience. If you had money, you owned a Cadillac. Upper Deck was pretty much the Cadillac of 1989 cars. If you didn't have a lot of money and all you could afford was the Chevrolet, well, that was your Bowman or Top set from 1989. So depending on your income level, you could select the card type that you liked. And if you were in the market for a Cadillac, well, there you go. Upper Deck was able to provide that for you. Now, on the downside, this is how Upper Deck, in my opinion, made the hobby worse. For those of us who were kids at that age, we were not in the market for a Cadillac. At least most of us weren't. So we were never able really to invest in those high-quality cards until we got a little older and got a little more money. I know I wasn't able to buy my first box of Upper Deck until, I think, 92, maybe 91. But, you know, it took a few years. And, you know, those boxes of Upper Deck were not cheap. You know, they were $35, $40 as opposed to a box of Tops or Fleer, which you could get for $20, $25, depending on the year. So, I missed out a lot on Upper Deck, not only in 1989, but for many years to come. And it also was bad for the industry in terms of children collecting, because it set the precedent for what base cards were supposed to be. Instead of just being the Cadillac set compared to all the other sets, kind of like that General Motors model, by the early 90s, everybody tried to be a Cadillac. And that actually happens in the automotive industry today. I mean, how many times have you seen a Hyundai designed to look like a Jaguar? You know, it's still a Hyundai, but they dress it up and they mark up the price. And, you know, it's the luxury brand of Hyundai. And it just kind of sort of looks like a Jaguar. So people buy it. Well, that's what was happening by the early 90s. Not only were the base sets trying to look like Upper Deck, and certainly by, I'd say, 93, that was the case. Tops, Fleer, Donruss, Score, Bowman. They were, you know, the standard sets, they were all trying to be high-end. Well, also, by 1992, you had the high-end subsets. Everybody had one. Topps released Stadium Club in 91. That was really the first direct competition against Upper Deck in terms of high-quality, low-quantity cards that were, very unique and had all sorts of bells and whistles that the standard top set didn't have. Now, unlike a Topps Tiffany set, which was just a copy of the regular set released in a smaller number, of course, Stadium Club released in larger numbers with different photography, different graphics, and all that fun stuff. So Topps had Stadium Club, Fleer would come up with Ultra, Donruss had Leaf, Bowman, like I said, tried to really become a standard bearer of, quality cards that focused on rookies, and that's what the Bowman set still does. I mean, I've bought a few packs of Bowman cards, and, you know, I don't know every baseball organization up and down through the ranks of their minor league system. I just know that I get a pack of cards with guys who, if they see the major leagues, it's not going to be for another 6 or 7 years. So, Bowman started going that way. So the thing is that all of a sudden, everybody's bass set had to be like the Cadillac, and then they had to spin off the bass set to have a second Cadillac set that was out there. And then, you know, Upper Deck would try to stay in the lead. They would still try to have the edge by having special subsets. Do you remember the Reggie Jackson subset, which not only had special Reggie Jackson cards, but maybe you got the autographed Reggie Jackson card. So all of a sudden, there's value there. They did the exact same thing with Ted Williams one year. Well, everybody then had to one-up them. Well, wait a minute. We need a subset within our subset. We need chrome cards. We need gold cards. We need refractor cards. We need autograph cards. We need swaths of clothing from the 1932 St. Louis Cardinals cut up and put into cards. All of a sudden, in the attempt to out upper deck, the subsets grew too much. The different base sets grew too much, and there was just way too much out there. And none of these sets were affordable to kids. They weren't. With the exception of Don Russ's attempt at a kid's set called Triple Play, which actually wasn't that bad of a set, but because it was, you know, high quantity, you know, it wasn't UV, you know, coating and special photography. It was aimed at kids. Collectors didn't want. So, you know, there wasn't much of a value to that. You know, outside of that attempt by Don Russ in the early 90s, all of these cards, all of a sudden we went from 45 cents a pack, you know, Upper Deck in 89 was a dollar a pack, to where you're spending $3, $4, $5 a pack for a pack of cards that, you know, you might get five cards in. So the value was not that good if you weren't guaranteed a big rookie, a big star card, or one of these very special insert cards. So Upper Deck, while raising the bar, helped the industry. It hurt the industry in that everybody tried to be like them. There was no more standard General Motors approach of, okay, you're the Cadillac, you're the Pontiac, you're the Buick, you're the Chevrolet. Everybody tried to be Cadillac. And by doing so, production costs go up, retail sales go up, retail price points go up. And while collectors and hobby store owners could afford to buy and sell these cards, kids were left out in the dust. And couple that with the baseball strike in 1994, and all of a sudden, you know, if you're a kid, you know, and I'll use myself as an example. When the baseball strike happened in 1994, I was 16 years old. I had no interest in the sport, in the hobby, and, you know, for a few years, I just totally gave up on baseball, and for more than a few years, I gave up on the hobby. And again, it goes back to the price of the cards. You know, when I'm 16 years old and I'm already, you know, turning my nose at baseball because the players and owners decide to have that strike and cancel the World Series, well, hey, I'm 16. I've got more interest in girls. I'm trying to, you know, buy a car. You know, I'm trying to get a job to, you know, go party and do stuff like that. All of a sudden, spending $3 or $4 on a pack of five baseball cards in the hope I get the purple refractor as opposed to the black refractor kind of goes by the wayside. And, you know, I still to this day, even though I'll occasionally buy a pack of cards here or there, while it's neat to pull the insert cards, some of the inserts and some of the subsets to the subsets to the subsets, even though Topps is pretty much the only company that has the licensed products out there, I still think it's a little silly. And I actually caught myself. You know, I was buying, you know, Heritage. And Heritage is my favorite set these days. I'm buying Heritage. And then I'm buying Opening Day. And then I'm buying this. And then I'm buying that. I'm like, what the hell am I buying all these cards for? You know, it's almost like an addiction. It all started with Upper Deck in 1989. Not that they intended for that consequence to happen, but that's really how it happened. And then, of course, you know, the downside is that with Upper Deck coming along, Bowman as well in 1989, as I mentioned, all of these premium subsets came out and then subsets to the subsets. The downside to 89 Upper Deck is that while its intention was to create a set for collectors that was high quality, low quantity, it really just blew the dam wide open. It just blew it up. And it wasn't instantly. It's not like every other car company by 1990 said, oh, we got to do this. took a few years. Like I said, 92, 93, for the most part, that's when things really went wild and crazy in terms of production. But it still happened. This was the trigger device right here. That was it. So there's some positives to 89 Upper Deck and the entire Upper Deck run with baseball cards. There are some negatives, but there is no doubt, for better or for worse, this card changed the industry and still changes it to this day. Like I said, you still have, even though Topps is the only officially licensed producer of Major League Baseball cards, Topps will still turn out Heritage. They'll turn out their base set. They'll turn out Opening Day. They'll turn out Allen and Ginter. They'll turn out Turkey Red. They'll turn out Archives. They'll turn out Black Label. They've got so many sets that have subsets in them, and then subsets to the subsets. It still carries on to this day. Almost 30 years later, it's kind of crazy. All right, Cecil Fielder, almost 30 years later. You kind of forget that this was a guy whose 51 home runs in 1990 was the first time anybody had hit 50 or more home runs in 13 years. The previous player to do it, George Foster, with the Cincinnati Reds in 1977. By the late 1990s and early 2000s, with PED use in rampant use, 50 home runs, well, everybody hit 50 home runs, didn't they? 50 home runs, ho-hum, give me 70, come on. So, people forget that Cecil Fielder, with 51 home runs in 1990, was pretty revolutionary. And it was revolutionary for a number of reasons. First of all, he was doing it with Detroit, a team that was starting to fall off the radar, but this guy would hit some monster home runs. I remember one in Tiger Stadium, he hit, I think it was 493 feet to left center field, actually hit the roof of Tiger Stadium. Not a Reggie Jackson hitting the light standard kind of blast, but still a mammoth home run, and that's what Cecil did throughout his career. Now, one reason, too, that the Cecil Fielder story is so amazing is prior to this 51 home run season, he was just your average run-of-the-mill first baseman with the Toronto Blue Jays. In fact, Cecil didn't even play for the Blue Jays in 1989. He was over in Japan. He was involved in a logjam of first basemen. The Blue Jays had up-and-coming star Fred McGriff. They had the trusty Willie Upshaw. And Cecil, even though he could hit some big home runs, he could also strike out quite a bit. In fact, he would strike out once every three at-bats on average here. So he couldn't quite work his way out of the logjam. Decides to go to Japan. He hits the ball out of the park quite a bit over there. Comes back, signs with Detroit as a free agent, and in 1990 is an all-star. Like I said, 51 home runs, 132 RBI. He was the runner-up in the MVP voting, and he was a silver slugger as well. Pretty much repeated that in 1991. All-star, runner-up in the MVP voting, silver slugger, 44 home runs, 133 RBI, as the Tigers did have a little bit of a chase, ultimately losing the American League East to the Toronto Blue Jays, ironically Fielder's former team. And he would continue to smash the ball out of the park for several years. 35 home runs in 92. Another all-star season in 93 with 30 home runs and 28 home runs in the shortened 1994 season. Unfortunately, the Tigers were starting to go downhill in the mid-90s. They were starting to break up the band, and that included Cecil Fielder. As at the trade deadline in 1996, he was traded to the New York Yankees for Matt Drews, who never made it out of the minor leagues, and Ruben Sierra. So the Tigers taking on a much more veteran player in Ruben Sierra and dishing him off to the Yankees, and Cecil would win a World Series with the Yankees in 1996. Had a pretty good World Series, too, against the Atlanta Braves. Hit .391. No home runs, but batting, got on base quite a few times, batted in a couple runs. Now, he would spend one more season with the Yankees, and then he would sign with the Anaheim Angels in 1997. Didn't have a very productive half season with the Angels, as he hit only .241, 17 home runs in 103 games. Now, granted, the Angels were starting to circle the drain a little bit, so he would latch on with the Cleveland Indians as a free agent in August of 1998. And that was the swan song for Cecil Fielder, as he would finish up playing just 14 games for the Indians, never hit a ball out of the park, and managed just a .143 batting average. Also 13 strikeouts in 35 at bats. So it was pretty obvious the strikeout tendency was still there, but hitting the big home runs didn't happen anymore. Now, for Cecil Fielder, life after baseball was not necessarily a good thing. In fact, just a few years after he retired, there were numerous reports of him owing a lot of debt to a lot of people, mostly casinos. He had a gambling issue. He had a lot of credit card debt. He had a lot of debt owed to banks. He was sued several times. So he had to go through that. Then he became an agent for his son, Prince Fielder. And there was a little bit of a dispute as to how much money Cecil would get for negotiating the contract for Prince when he was with the Milwaukee Brewers. So Prince and Cecil actually went their separate ways for several years. Now, stories say that they kind of rekindled their relationship in previous seasons. But, you know, when you've got, a father who is in debt and who is acting as an agent and then looking for his cut, sometimes people can get desperate in desperate situations like that. And that's just an absolute killer to a relationship between a father and a son. And again, a little more misfortune in the Fielder story. As you know, Prince Fielder not officially retiring, but not playing baseball anymore, currently with the Texas Rangers organization. But Prince Fielder has herniated disc in the C4 and C5 section of the spine, basically spinal stenosis. And I have spinal stenosis, and I can tell you, as somebody who is not playing a sport 270 days a year, 162 games a year, not training, not running around, not swinging a bat, not living that lifestyle, cervical stenosis sucks. It is not fun. You have your good days, but you certainly have your bad days. And I can only imagine for Prince Fielder having to, do the usual rigmarole of being a baseball player year round. And Prince isn't really skinny, carrying around all that extra weight. It has to be absolutely miserable for him. So even though Cecil Fielder was a star on the field, you wouldn't have known it with this 1989 Upper Deck car, because like I said, he was more of a platoon, borderline major league player first baseman caught in the logjam of Fred McGriff and Willie Upshaw in Toronto. He would turn out to be a star in Detroit, an all-star, three-time all-star with Detroit. He would set American League or Major League season records for home runs hit in 90 and 91, winning a World Series in 96. So he pretty much wraps up his career as a champion, even though his career ended a couple years later. Even though he had lots of accolades on the field, unfortunately, the news that Cecil's made over the past 15, 20 years off the field, be it his debts, his gambling issues, his domestic issues, his split with his son, that unfortunately has kind of ruled over him. But again, in a day and age where 50 home runs was commonplace and you weren't a home run hitter unless you had at least 65 or 70, Cecil Fielder, what he did, hitting 51 in 1990, hitting 44 in 1991, really re-energized baseball in Detroit. Like I said, the Tigers are starting to slip off the radar a little bit, but also in Major League Baseball, the home run became fun once again. And it's funny, I remember Fred McGriff in 89 led the majors in home runs with 36. So you think about it, you have a leader with 36 in 89, then all of a sudden 51 in 1990. And that certainly opened some eyes. Now, much like Upper Deck in 89, for better or for worse, the long ball opened some eyes in baseball, and we all know that a lot of the PED use, and this isn't linking PED use to Cecil Fielder. I don't believe they are connected. But with how much love and affection and money Cecil was getting to hit the ball out of the park, we all know that the PED use started becoming rampant, especially in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area in the early 1990s. So for better, we saw lots of home runs. For worse, it may have come at the cost of the legitimacy of the game. And a whole generation of fans lost because of a strike, because of PED use, and overpriced baseball cards. That it's taken baseball almost 25 years to pull back in. So there you go. The ups and downs, the pros, the cons, the pluses and minuses, not only of Cecil Fielder's life, but 89 Upper Deck, all wrapped up into this very lengthy podcast. Normally, I try to keep my podcast to about 25 or 30 minutes, but with such a revolutionary product like 89 Upper Deck, we have to go on a long discussion. there's a lot to talk about. So if you've made it this far, thank you so much for listening to this podcast in its entirety. We'll have another podcast coming your way on Tuesday as we look at the other new set in 1989. Not as highly regarded as Upper Deck, but I will give Bowman its due. It's time to look back at 89, 90, and 91 Bowman. Those were some really good sets. And we'll talk about 89 Bowman in our next podcast. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Don't forget to share our podcast with your friends. Share our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains as well. And we'll see you in our next edition of Wax Ecstatic coming up on Tuesday.